He had a big illusion where a volunteer actually would be put into this giant projectile bullet case and stuffed into a giant cannon, and that the face of the cannon was then wheeled up against a big plate of sheet metal, and she would be fired through this plate of metal and land in a net on the other side. One day, this bullet came out, landed in the net, and the securing hook on the net came loose and flew up and hit the head of one of the assistants in the show and killed her.
Magicians have secrets that you don't see on stage. I'm not talking about how they do the tricks, you know, the trapdoors and mirrors, but the mundane secrets that make the magic happen. I'm talking about the tour schedules, the marketing plans, the box office reports, and the horror stories of gigs that went off the rails. Kent Blackmore digs up those secrets. An author and magic historian, Kent has dedicated his life to telling the stories of Australia's most colourful figures, from William Fraser, the convict conjurer, to magic superstars like Les and Esme Levant. Blackmore has spent decades piecing together posters, newspaper articles and ephemera to explore not just the stage personas, but the stories of the people behind the magic. On this episode of Scammapalooza, I talk to Kent about collecting and conjuring. If you enjoy the podcast, why not support the show on Patreon? There's a link in the show notes. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I thought I would start by asking you, you are a collector of magic and magic paraphernalia, but you're also a researcher, as well as, I guess, an archivist and a writer. What drives all of that?
It's all about the stories, and I do it firstly for my own interest because it fascinates me. But there are a lot of collectors in magic who accumulate, you know, posters and books and photographs and things, and they never share them. And I think that's pointless. You know, you can accumulate all this stuff, but the greatest magic historian of recent years, Eddie Dawes in the UK, said, first of all, you have to collect the stuff, then you have to collate it or put it together to make a meaningful story, and then you have to communicate it, because what's the point of having stories that aren't told? The whole basis of human civilization really is on telling stories and communicating. So I have become a collector by default, because in the process of researching into those stories, you then come across people who say, oh, I've got this postcard or a photograph or something like that, would you like it? And so you go, yeah, that'll be lovely. And so you end up becoming an accidental collector.
Because when I think of magic collectors, I think of David Copperfield, who yeah. just has spent millions of dollars on collecting posters, props, paraphernalia, photos, and so on. And while he does let people come for visits, he doesn't seem to be that interested in sharing his collection with the world.
Yeah, it's becoming more open than it used to be. Copperfield, I guess, has started off collecting things for his own personal interest. And you have to say that he's doing the magic world a service by keeping these things safe and protecting them. But again, you know, it's just a closed cupboard. If you don't let people in to have a look at the things and understand what these things are about, then they're really of no importance. They're just bits of wood and cardboard. And, you know, it's the stories around them that make it important.
It's interesting the way in which you talk about it. You are essentially like a one-man cultural institution in that you're doing the collection, you're doing the preservation, you're also doing restoration of things which have been damaged, and then also, you know, communicating with the public. I mean, as you know, like I worked with the State Library of Victoria with the Alma collection, and there's often a tension between those various areas within the library. So the library will have librarians who are trying to keep the books safe, but then they have an audience engagement team who are trying to get the books out there for people to see. And then you have a conservation team who are trying to make sure that they're looked after or restored. And there can be a real a real tension between all those different areas. Do you find that? Do you find that yourself?
I do. When the State Library of New South Wales a year or so ago was having a small exhibition, very good exhibition on magic up at the gallery there, I lent them a few photographs, and the meticulous care that they took of these photographs was unbelievable. I mean, I have them safely stored in a folder, but they were, you know, wrapping them in tissue paper and handling them with white gloves. And that's great because you know that your stuff's going to be looked after. But there is that balance between keeping them safe and getting them accessible and seen by the public. And I have had a few friends who have been at that same mindset, that they want to protect things by keeping them at home and hiding them away and never sharing them. And it just seems pointless to me. Sharing is the ultimate goal.
I guess in terms of there's obviously limitations. You know, there is how are we going to share that information if something is particularly fragile or particularly old? You have to sort of be able to control how that's been protected in some way. I do think, though, with some of the, and maybe I think I don't have a very charitable view of collectors in general, not just in magic, but I've seen how, I think because most of them, I meet them at auctions when they're trying to get their hands on things, and they've got a real sense of they want to not just preserve it, but they want to control it. They want to be the person who has the thing that nobody else has. Much like there are magicians who like to just have the secrets, you know, like that's, they feel powerful and they feel a bit smug because they have, you know, they know how the trick is done and other people don't. I feel like sometimes collectors, not just magic collectors, but all collectors, they like to know I'm the person who has this and no one else does.
Yeah, you can see that on a lot of collectors groups where it is really a matter of show and tell and, you know, hey, I've got this and, you know, I pay $30,000 for this. It doesn't interest me. I accumulate whatever I can get my hands on. But I'm not going to be spending vast amounts of money just for the sake of saying I own this. If somebody else has an important piece, I'm quite happy for them to have that. But collectors are a funny bunch and they will go and pay big bucks for something that's not really worth it, essentially.
Isn't it the case, though, that it becomes worth it because they spent the big bucks? There's a gambling book that I have called Road Hustlers, which it's a book of cheating, card cheating, but it's not written by a magician. It's written by a sociologist, and it's about the sociology of card cheats. And for a while there, everyone was very obsessed with getting a copy of this book, and the price just kept going up and up and up. And then at some point, people just went, I think after it was reprinted, Richard Kaufman did like a reprint of it, and suddenly people just weren't interested in the book anymore, and the value went down.
The only value is what somebody's willing to pay for something, but in the case of a book, my sort of view of that is that it's the information in the book, not so much the fact that it was printed in 1600 or whenever. It's great to have and to hold these things and to treasure them for the object that it is. But ultimately, it has to be, what does this contribute to your knowledge?
I had a situation where there was a book that I really wanted. I was actually in the book as well. I'd contributed to the book, but I never got a copy of the book. And so I approached the author and said, hey, how can I get a copy of the book? And they said, oh, no, you can't get a copy. Can't be done. And so I went, well, I'm in the book and I really want this book. And I ended up paying way too much for it because it was in such, I think I paid $500 for the book. And then 3 months later, the author re-released the book in a paperback edition. And so, because I only wanted the information in the book, so I had spent, and it was worth it for the information, but I can now get the book for that information for $50 instead of $500. So there's a real tension there with the, as you said, the value of what's in the book versus its value as an object for collectors, right?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I certainly treasure some of the items that I have because they have that uniqueness about them. I own one of Les Levant's original touring albums that he travelled around the world from the 1920s. But it's no good just sitting on my shelf for me to look at and sort of dribble over. But it was at the home of a former magician who had it there for, you know, 35, 40 years and never showed it to anybody. And so in that term, I regard it as having no value at all. And the funny thing is that the original owners of some of these props and books and things have no regard at all. It's just like, no, you know, here's a piece of junk I've had sitting around for years. Do you want it? One man's trash is another man's treasure. So it all depends what you can get out of it personally. I've paid big money for a few items, but...
Yeah, Panatello was in Australia recently collecting and so on, and he was talking about a specific book that he really wanted to get republished because the information in it was so important. And the story of how he managed to convince the non-magicians who owned all the papers and all this information that was going to go into this book, and how he convinced them that this was not worth a lot of money, but it was worth a lot historically and to magicians, they had to jump through a lot of hoops because the difference between what a, you know, what it's worth financially versus what it's worth historically versus what it's worth to the family of the guy who had written all of this information. It's all these different types of value that can't necessarily kind of be put into dollars and cents.
Absolutely right. I know the two particular books that are out there in Australia that have great historical connections and I would love to get hold of. But I've had discussions with the owners and they sort of say, no, no, that's a family book, you know, I want to keep that. And you just have to respect those wishes. And all you can do is sort of say, well, think of me. If you ever want to dispose of the book, come and see me. But it's not the end of the world. It's, you know, just one more thing that you didn't have before and you still don't have it. So move on.
Yes. I was on the flip side of that. My grandfather was a ventriloquist in... the UK in the 1930s and 40s, and he had a particular type of ventriloquist dummy, that a real traditional ventriloquist dummy, but it had a latex face, so you couldn't see the joints of the jaw moving, its lips moved up and down, its eyebrows moved, it could smoke a cigarette, it could cry, had little tear ducts and spit water. I started to get emails from all over the world from people offering me thousands of dollars. The approaches that people had were sort of people said, oh, I haven't got any money, but I collect and, you know, restore them, or I collect them and, you know, we're going to send them all to Vent Haven, which is a museum of ventriloquist dummies. And, but people got really sort of aggressive about getting their hands on these materials.
Yeah. People do get very close to this subject. And because I'm almost the only magic history researcher in Australia, with the exception of people who are doing it in slightly different areas. There's a few others, self-included, over the course of time when you're doing a state library exhibition research. You have to remind yourself on occasion that this is a very small niche field. And not everyone's interested. In fact, a great many people are just not interested in what you're doing. So you get all excited and you go, oh, wow, I've just written this fabulous story and, you know, it goes out online. And then all you hear is, you know, the sound of crickets in the background. There is no reaction, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then several years down the track, someone will bump across this article and go, wow, you know, this is the story of my great-great-grandfather or something like that. And I'll get messages from them saying, I've just found this article and thank you so much and it's wonderful. So it's a teeny tiny field and you don't want to overrate the importance of what you're doing. But at the same time, there is genuine historical value in what you're doing and eventually someone will make use of it. So that it's worth the effort of putting this stuff out there.
So your area of interest is obviously Australian magicians.
Yes.
And it doesn't seem like there is, and mostly it seems like early Australian magicians, in the sense of that you don't seem to do a lot of research for. I mean, I don't think you have a file on me in your collection.
No, but if I had one of your flyers, it would be filed away in a
book okay.
where I can find it. Everything's neatly stored so that I can locate what I need to. The problem is that just being a one-man band, I don't have enough time in my life to finish all my research. Literally, I have over 100 magicians yet to be documented before the year 1900, and I'll be dead by the time any of that gets finished off. So the prospect of going past 1900, or even, you know, coming up to the 21st century, for me is impossible. Somebody else is going to have to take it on and say, I want to write stories about, you know, people who are currently working around in Australia today. There's just not the time in life to be able to do it.
Magicians, I think, like a lot of entertainers and artists, like to think that we're special because it is, as you said, such a small field. And yet when you look, oh, actually, there's, you know, maybe 30 or 40 professional magicians in Melbourne. And you go, oh, actually, Australia-wide, there's probably a couple of thousands of them. And then you start looking back in history and you realize how many people there are who have had this job and lived this life and done these things. And you realize, oh, wow, my delusions of stardom and uniqueness become sort of dwarfed by this long history. I mean, how many magicians are there, would you say, just Australian magicians whose names were some variation of Wizard of the North or Wizard of the South or Wizard of the East and West? Like, there's even just that name seems to show up over and over again in history.
So many that literally I have devoted one of my pages on my website to listing all of those names, and there would be, off the top of my head, 40 or more. Everyone wanted to be the Wizard of the North or the South or the East or the West, and it became a bit of a joke over the years, but eventually it sort of faded out. John Henry Anderson, who called himself the Wizard of the North because he came from Scotland. It's just one of those typical magical sort of things, you know, the world's greatest magician. Everyone's the world's greatest magician.
How do you, as a researcher, separate the facts of a magician's life from the fiction of their marketing and performance?
You have to be very, very skeptical. And what I try to do is not print anything that isn't actually backed up by first-hand reference. So if I can actually see that somebody has gone to perform in front of the Shah of Persia and that was reported in the newspapers, that's good. You can go and report it. If somebody says in their advertising that they've travelled all around the world to Europe and Asia and there, you sit back and go, right, well, let's go and look for the facts, because so many magicians, as you say, just outright lie about what they've been and what they've done. And occasionally their advertising is genuine, but very often you just have to be skeptical first. Most of my research of it has to be through the newspapers and the digital resource that's available through the National Library's Trove service. And so there is this difference between what you read in the newspapers and the publicity stories, and then sometimes you can get behind the scenes and find out the actual facts. But as you read through the newspapers, you get to identify what is just a piece of publicity fluff, because the newspapers will say, oh, you know, Professor Freddo is coming to town and he's the world's greatest magician and, you know, the audiences love him. And then you see that same article in six or seven different newspapers and you realise that all it is the magician has sent his publicity piece to the paper and they've just reprinted it verbatim. And that is a typical publicity ploy that is still in use today. If you send
that,
so that's where you need to be very careful about the stories that people are telling. And I really do, occasionally I will say, this is what was claimed, or this is what the person said, but I'll phrase it in such a way that it indicates that, you know, there is no proof behind the thing. And magicians, of course, are also hiding behind pseudonyms and stage names, and the reality of their life is often very far divorced from the supposed glamour that they put out in their publicity. It's one of the things that interests me most, to find out the real story behind their life, because a lot of the magicians were just struggling. You know, some of them were starving to death, and they were, you know, trying to make ends meet. And so in their publicity, it's like, you know, major success. The audiences are, you know, crowding the house every night. And then a week later, there's a report that they've gone bankrupt because no one's been coming to the shows. So there is this, again, tension between the difficulties of being a professional performer and the impression that you have to put out to your audience that you are the great magician who goes from one success to another. Any theatrical life is a hard life, and I've got so many friends who are into acting, and they've done all the training, and you know, and they're very open about it, that 90% of their time is going to be spent chasing jobs or being unemployed. It is a difficult life, and the glamour is just the facade that magicians put on the front.
I mean, it's difficult because that facade is necessary to an extent, in that a stand-up comedian could stand up and talk about why their life is difficult and why they're struggling and get laughs and be successful as a performer. As a magician, magic, I guess, is we're presented as being people who are in control. You know, a magician is presented as someone who knows what they're doing and has a very specific set of skills, whether those skills are real, like being a card sharp, or whether they're imaginary, like being a mind reader. But the idea that the magician isn't in control and doesn't have their shit together. I don't know many magicians who you come away going, man, that guy hasn't got his shit together.
Yeah, the audience really doesn't want to know that you've got a wife and kids at home who you're desperately trying to support. But the magician Les Levant used to travel around with his family, and his young daughter was sitting off stage in a bassinet at one stage while he was sawing his wife Gladys in half. And so Gladys is lying in this box just about to be sawn in two, and Esme was off in the wings crying. And the story is that Gladys was sort of whispering to Les, for God's sake, Les, you know, Esme's in the bassinet, you know, crying her head off, get on with it. You know, just do the bloody act and get on.
Let's talk about Levant, because even though you said you focus on sort of pre 20th century magicians, Levant would have to be is a 20th century magician who you have probably researched more than anyone else. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I sort of leapt into my current frame of researching magicians only after I'd written the book on Levant. And I sort of said, well, okay, if I'm going to become a writer, where do I start? And the obvious answer was, you start at the very beginning. You go and find the very earliest magicians who ever came to Australia. And then I've worked my way up from there. But back in the 90s, in fact, in the late 80s, I had written one small monograph on another magician by the name of Oscar Eliasson, or Dante the Great. And I was just looking for another project to do. So the obvious thing was write about the biggest name in Australia, because Les Levant, the Australian illusionist, had only died in 1978. And it was clear that nobody else was going to write this story. There was just nothing happening. So it was a question of, you know, you have to do something now while people are still alive and tell those stories. And it was the biggest mistake of my life that Les's wife and his daughter were still both alive into the 1980s when I was sort of half considering doing this book. But I was lacking in confidence, you know, as a total novice, and it's like, how dare I suggest that I could go and write the life of this great magician? And so I didn't approach them to hear their stories. Both of them died, and it was the biggest head slap I could have had. It was like, you idiot, you know, you've lost the greatest resource that you could have ever had. So then in the early 90s, I had to go and do all this research into Levant and his life by talking to other people who knew him and finding sources and information. And fortunately, he had written his own partial autobiography, so I was able to use a lot of that information. But it was just such a good story because Levant started out in Australia as a small-time magician. He worked overseas, became a big-time magician, and literally he was the last of the big illusion show, the live golden age of magic style of performers before movies started to take over. And he just got in at the time when things were starting to fade off. So he was Australia's most successful export and the last of the big-time illusionists in that respect.
Yeah, he seems like one of the last magicians to fit the stereotype of magician in the sense of when you see a cartoon of it. If you do a Google image search for magician and it comes up with someone with a top hat and a cape and that whole image, he was one of the last magicians to really fit that stereotype.
He was very much the grand, you know, master of magic. And when he was on stage, you know, he would tug at the sleeves of his tailcoat, and he would be, he was a friendly magician. He wasn't aloof and sort of, you know, trying to pretend that he was the greatest of all time. But as you said earlier, he was somebody who was in control, and anything might have gone wrong never flustered him. So he was very much the great Levant right through to the end of his life.
He was, though. I mean, things did go wrong for Levant. I remember in your book, somebody died during one of his. Was it during a? It was the bullet, the human bullet, I think it was called.
Yes, it was the case that he had a big illusion where a volunteer actually from the town that he was playing in would be put into this giant projectile bullet case and stuffed into a giant cannon, and the face of the cannon was then wheeled up against a big plate of sheet metal. And the magic illusion was that she would be fired through this plate of metal and land in a net on the other side. So it wasn't the girl in the bullet who was affected, but one day this bullet came out, landed in the net, and the securing hook on the net came loose and flew up and hit the head of one of the assistants in the show. And sadly, it killed her the next day. It was a complete accident, but very much a disaster that knocked them around terribly much.
And he had a lot of those large-scale illusions. I mean, it was a show in which it felt as if Levant was always feeling like he had to add lots, you know, everything had to be big. Well, not everything had to be big, but there had to be lots of big illusions. There had to be lots of people on stage. There was a sense of looking at the history that he wanted to have as many assistants as possible and as many props as possible and as many things as possible in order to justify his claim of being this grand magician.
He spent the first 4 years of his time when he arrived in Britain in 1933, and he was touring around with a smaller show which had, I think, something like 10 assistants. But over the course of those 4 years, he bought up the props of some other magicians who had died or retired. And he was always building towards this big show, which opened in 1937. And that was the peak of his career, I guess. He called the show House Tricks. And it was, as you say, full of, you know, huge illusions and big fancy showy sort of things. And he would make a point of dressing the show in a way that would appeal to the wives of the magicians who didn't really want to come along to see the magic, but they would come along to see, you know, a good display of costumes and, you know, something attractive to watch. It wasn't always the case that Les was able to maintain that size of the show, because afterwards, as theatre started to decline, it was just almost impossible to be able to tour that sort of thing around the countryside. And one of the things that I love so much is the resilience of magicians in carting these tons of boxes and illusions and props from one place to another and getting them set up in the next theatre ready to do a show.
Yeah, it also goes to that, what we're talking about before, of the reality of how hard life is off stage, even for someone as successful as him, and how effortless everything appears when they're on stage. It reminds me of the story, Where Did the Ducks Go? That was one of his most famous tricks, which was, Where Did the Duck Go? Sorry, where a duck would disappear on stage it's a very funny routine that is still performed today by magicians. But then in your book, you reveal where the ducks would go after the show. They would eat them, right? Whether a duck got too old or, I don't know, died, they would just eat the duck.
John Newman, who was one of Melbourne's great theatrical personalities and has written his own book of the story of his life, he was in Tiki and John's theatre restaurant up in Exhibition Street for many years. Travelled around as an assistant to the Levants in the 1950s, and the 50s were a pretty tough time because that's when everything really was shutting down and turning into cinemas. And yes, Les invited him over for a beautiful duck dinner one night and then said, oh, I've got to go out and find some more ducks, because he had just eaten the act, literally.
You hear similar stories from the Sloggett family, who, you know, obviously touring at similar times, but with, I would say, less success, where they would have props that would be eaten or destroyed or sold, or, you know, things were it was real feast and famine way to live, even for the most successful magicians. When things started to get rough in the 50s, that was when Esme, his daughter, started to perform her own solo act. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Esme and Gladys, who was Les's wife, were the real workers behind the show. Les was quite happy to let everyone do the stage set up for him, and then he would put on his tails and walk out and be the great Levant. But Esme and Gladys were the real, you know, sewers of the costumes and make sure that the props were all correct and everything. And it became obvious that Esme was not going to be able to be the successor to the great Levant and take on this big illusion show. Instead, she got together a number of smaller props which could be worked in cabarets and nightclubs. And she was a very personable performer. I mean, she'd literally grown up with the show, being a dancer and performer and singer and magician with her father. And so she took some smaller props. And if you can name a big, important cabaret or nightclub anywhere in Europe, Esme would have played one of those. She was a very high-class performer in her time. Sadly, though, she was afflicted with rheumatoid arthritis, which killed off her career quite soon after she had been performing, much too early. She had to retire.
Was there much tension between Esme and Les? I got the impression that they weren't always on the best of terms.
you have to read between the lines, and speaking to other members of the family, it's quite clear that when you've been touring around and, you know, living in digs and shifting places and having to go to school in, you know, wherever you can find, there is no illusion about whether or not theatrical life is glamorous or not. And Esme had a very clear knowledge that this was not the life that she wanted her son to be involved in. So I don't think it was the case that there was sort of arguments or you know, dislike between father and daughter, but there was this thing of, I don't want my family to have to go through the tough times or to have to do the same things that I did. It's the same with circus families. You more or less are expected, just because you're a member of the family, to have to you know, share your part of the load. And eventually people just sort of get to the point where they say, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to retire. I want to settle down in one place and live a comfortable, stable life. And I think that's where Esme wanted to be. She was capable of doing all this stuff, but she'd done it for long enough.
It's a case of running away from the circus rather than running away with the circus.
You've seen behind the curtains, and it's not all that it's cracked up to be sometimes.
Charles Sloggett's, I think, second wife, he had four wives, and his second wife was an employee, and then when they married, she stopped getting paid and had to do more work because now she was a member of the family. And there's a letter in which she wrote in the 80s talking about what she had to do backstage, and it was everything. She was the doctor, she was the tailor, she was the stage manager, she was a performer, and it was a pretty brutal life for her.
Yeah, and the Sloggetts, when you have a look at their posters, which funnily enough I'm in the process of helping Alan to sell off now.
Alan is Charles Sloggett's son.
Yes. And I just have some of the remnants of his working posters and bills that used to get put up on the walls. But when you look at some of the town names that are there and you look them up on Google Maps, they are little intersections in the back of Bourke somewhere where there would have been 10 or 20 people living. And Sloggett will go out and put on his full evening show for them. And That's what I find most admirable about these people, that they just had the tenacity to get out and do this sort of stuff to entertain people and to make themselves a living. But, the Sloggetts, and indeed Levant in his early days, was that same sort of country touring performer. In fact, at one stage he drove across from Sydney to Perth, right across the Nullarbor Plains in the 1920s, which is just something that hadn't been done before, just because that was who he was. No challenge seemed too much for him.
Yeah, there's a real sense of grit and determination, mm-hmm. and a sense, I think, for a lot of them that they did it because there wasn't anything else they could do.
Yeah.
I think maybe for the kids they could go and do something else. But for the fathers, because they were fathers, it was, this is who I am, this is what I do, there isn't anything else that I can do, so I'm just going to keep doing this.
And you hear occasionally some of the backstories of some of these magicians who have taken on other roles as publicans is a typical thing. Someone will take over the role of running a hotel. And it's very often that those other jobs that they take on just collapse because they don't have the skills to be doing that sort of thing. Their real talent is being up on stage doing a show, but they have to make a living somehow. And so not every professional magician is full-time. They will have another job, and they will be out doing the magic shows whenever they can to make a living.
Yeah, that really hits like very close to the bone for me as someone who I've never the time I spent at the State Library is the closest I've ever had to a non-performing job. Everything else has been magic. And I quite enjoyed it. It was quite enjoyable to go into an office and so on, but I don't know whether I could do that. And it's quite scary to think, oh, what would I do if I couldn't do this? And for these guys, it was that, I think maybe was the driving force for a lot of them. You know, there wasn't anything else, so they just had to keep on grinding.
It is a certain mindset that some people can cope with the fact that they have to be constantly on the look for the next job or the next opportunity or promoting themselves to do that. And it's been suggested to me a number of times because I'm in sort of community theatre. Somebody say, oh, you should turn professional. And I just go, no, couldn't handle that. I like to have, you know, a steady income, know where I have a bed to sleep in every night. It's not mine.
Well, you've got a lot of books and posters and photo albums to buy at auctions, so you need a steady income.
That's right. Yeah.
I notice most of the big collectors of magic seem to be people who have another job or another source of income or independently wealthy. There's very few professional magicians who are also big collectors of magic.
One of the biggest collectors in the world who passed away just a few years ago was the head of a bakery, which ended up getting the contract to make bread rolls or buns for McDonald's. And you can imagine just how much money that would have brought in. So he had a fair bit of money to be able to play with, and he put it all into collecting magic, which is great for him.
Going back to Les Levant, do you think that someone like him, their success is from being a great magician or from being a great promoter and having that ability to create all this material and get out there and actually kind of pound the pavement?
Yes, there certainly is that image that you have to get out and sell. But Levant's real place in history is because of his personality off stage in a lot of ways. He was such a sociable person that he got to know everybody in the business and everybody got to know him. He was eternally helpful. He never looked down on, you know, the lowliest amateur magician he'd be prepared to sit and have a talk with. And particularly in Britain, his name is so highly regarded, just as somebody who was a participant and somebody who would contribute to magic all the time. So it wasn't only for his personality on stage. It was that the fact of who he was. He was a person who loved to sit and have a talk with other people and swap stories and to, you know, just be that person who was out learning about everything that was around him.
So it was the type of person who's part of the magic community as well as being a good magician as well.
Yes, I mean you will know some stories of very famous magicians and big time collectors who have a reputation for being cranky curmudgeons who don't want to talk to anyone. And I won't name names, but I'm sure you know exactly who I'm talking about. Les was the direct opposite of that. He was somebody who absolutely loved to socialise. And our common friend Steve Walker from Australia was that sort of person. His friends would go in on his tailcoat because he was the one who broke the ice and made friends with everybody. And you could sort of ride his tailcoat and get to meet all these wonderful magicians based on him breaking the ice. And the funny thing is that, going back to research, in the world of magic, it doesn't matter who you are. I mean, I'm just a guy. I'm just a person sitting at home doing my own research. But I've, in the last few weeks, had email conversations with some of the biggest collectors, historians, and magic creators, people who have designed magic for the biggest Broadway shows. And those people are quite happy to talk to you. If you've got something in common that they want to discuss, there's no, oh, I'm better than you. It's just, you know, two people talking and sharing information. And, you know, I'm sitting here sort of fangirling going, oh, my God, I'm speaking to XYZ. And it's wonderful. You make that entry to speak to some of the greatest experts and the cleverest people in the world just by the little things that you're doing.
I think that is something that I really love about magic in general, is that if you can do a double lift, or, you know, like if you know, if you've got a good ambitious card routine or know what a French drop is, you've got a friend, you know, you've got like, wait, you, it's like a, this sort of lovely little secret handshake that opens doors and connects you with people from all over the world. And it feels like and I guess also with the collecting, it's even though you are telling the stories of magicians, you do end up telling the story of Australia, the story, you know, the story of these small country towns, the stories of the ordinary people's lives, but through this quite extraordinary life.
For myself, because I'm doing this principally for myself to start with, and then just sharing it out, I have learned so much about all aspects of Australia. I mean, the history of the colonisation of Australia, people who came out from Britain and how they got here, the sailing ships, the colonial system where you had to go and apply to the colonial secretary for permission to perform. And that meant writing letters to apply for permission to do a show in Tasmania, somewhere there. All sorts of social history, and you start off researching magic, but the reach goes into all sorts of different areas. I've just been looking at waxworks and ventriloquists and the history of the Criterion Theatre in Sydney. It's just astonishing how wide your own knowledge gets to be. So just by researching magic, you're teaching yourself about the entire history of Australia, political and social and everything. And it's great. Inside my head is a little wonderland, but you can't share that with everyone.
No, but if people do want to check out some of what you've done, because there is so much, your website is sydneymagic.net. That would be the best one to go to. You've got a whole lot of information on the Great Levant, on Dante the Great, on Oscar Ellison, as well as just so many other Australian and Australian magicians. There are photographs and so many extraordinary resources that people can spend hours and hours going through. So I've
lived that long.
Yeah. I've spent so much time on your website over the years. Thank you so much for coming on Scammapalooza.
You're most welcome. Good to speak to you, Nicholas.